Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The responsibility to protect, established by the United Nations, is a governmental duty to respect and protect international human rights. This responsibility, its adoptions, and how countries, especially the United States, exercise it, is the topic of this second 2014 conversation with Dr. C.M. Brown. Dr. Brown is an adjunct senior fellow at the American Security Project in Washington, D.C. He has previously held senior research and policy analysis positions at the RAND Corporation, the Brookings Institute, the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and the Kennedy School of Government. He has also served as a special assistant in the Office of International Security Affairs at the Department of Defense and to the Director of Policy Planning at the Department of State. Dr. Brown has also taught at Harvard, Brandeis, Johns Hopkins, Columbia, the University of Chicago, and UCLA. When Dr. C.M. Brown visited Radio Curious on July 4, 2014, we began our conversation with a description of the responsibility to protect and the history of how this responsibility was established.
Well, responsibility to protect means that there is some agent, some government, that has the role that they should exercise to protect people within their jurisdiction from terrible harms, okay? That there is a responsibility that lies somewhere. People have rights that they can claim, but then the question is, who has the responsibility for making sure that these rights are respected? In the international legal documents on human rights, there's very little talk about responsibility. Rights are guaranteed by the various covenants on human rights of all kinds, political rights, economic rights, and so on. But the question is, whose responsibility is to assure that these rights are indeed respected and not violated?
When we talk about the legal covenants, can you give us some examples of what that baseline of rights are?
Mm-hmm. Well, the most frequently invoked declaration is the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights. That's a declaration that doesn't really have legal binding force. The effort to give it force was assumed in the 1960s when two basic covenants were enacted and set out for ratification. One was the Covenant on Economic and Social Rights, Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, and the other was the Covenant on Political and Civil Rights, Civil Liberties. These were then sent out for ratification, and they were ratified by a sufficient majority of countries.
So, in the United Nations?
Well, the United Nations is where they drafted it, but then it was sent out to governments around the world, either that sign it and then ratify it. This is different than a vote in the UN General Assembly. They bind themselves to respect this set of covenants.
How are the responsibilities to protect these rights assumed or determined?
Mm-hmm. Well, they weren't specified, and the notion of responsibility was hardly ever discussed. The rights were asserted, but who has the responsibility to make sure that they are delivered on was rarely discussed until in the early 1990s, that problem was flagged by the then Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, and a Canadian governmental-sponsored effort was undertaken to define the responsibilities that countries have to make sure that rights are protected. And they came up with a basic document called the Responsibility to Protect. And that had a number of tenets to it. One was that the primary responsibility to make sure that the rights enumerated in the various UN and international covenants, the primary responsibility resides with the member governments of the UN, the parties to those covenants or those treaties. But it went farther than that and said that if the responsibilities are not adequately provided by the member governments within their jurisdiction, that the responsibility then can be exercised or should be exercised by the international community. Okay. What this did, of course, is it overrode a basic standard premise of conventional international law that countries are not supposed to interfere in each other's affairs unless they themselves are attacked. Whatever governments do with respect to the people in their jurisdiction is essentially their business. Other governments can preach to them, can say what they should be doing, but the responsibility always resides with the member government.
It seems that that is not the current state of the world.
No, and it wasn't even when that notion was asserted. Countries did intervene in each other's affairs, but their intervention in others' affairs was always declared to be consistent with the United Nations Charter, which restricts such intervention to situations that threatened international peace and security. So if you're going to intervene in another country's international affairs, you have to make the case persuasively in the Security Council usually and get a Security Council endorsement of the assertion that what's happening in that country is threatening international peace and security.
That's a favored way of behavior without retaliation or sanction to the country that doesn't follow seeking the Security Council support.
That's right. If the United States intervenes in another country's affairs, militarily particularly, and it doesn't have Security Council support, okay, it can be regarded and charged with acting illegally. This happened, for example, in the Iraq War, where there was no, in Operation Iraqi Freedom, where there was no international support registered in the Security Council. Obviously, because some countries vetoed it and didn't want it to happen.
And the assertion there was a fear of weapons of mass destruction alleged against Saddam Hussein's government.
Yes, right. That was the fear. But it didn't stand up in the Security Council.
Or in reality.
After the fact, in reality. I mean, first we invaded and then discovered that the weapons didn't exist. But the assertion was made that they do exist, and that is a threat to international security, and that the Security Council didn't exercise its responsibility to find that it was a threat to international security. Therefore, the United States would organize a coalition of the willing countries to protect international peace and security by invading Iraq to get rid of the weapons of mass destruction.
And then the contemplated action can, in one form, be characterized as the responsibility to protect or aggression.
That's right. Those who object to it call it aggression. Those who are engaged in it call it the responsibility to protect. Now, however, in 1961, the effort was to expand this responsibility to protect, okay, not only into cases of international peace and security, when international peace and security was being violated by what happened in a particular country, and that country was not exercising its responsibility, okay, but the responsibility to protect should also be expanded to protect those whose basic human rights are being violated in another country. And the responsibility should be exercised by the international community when that violation is either deliberate or the result of incompetence of the government within whose jurisdiction the violations of human rights are taking place. So the responsibility to protect now by this new formulation of what international law required was put into the United Nations system. There was a debate over it. And the debate over it produced a General Assembly resolution which essentially endorsed this notion. The Security Council has not endorsed that notion.
So moving back to my earlier question, in retrospect, about the United States attacks on Iraq under either the responsibility to protect perspective or the aggression perspective as to weapons of mass destruction. What has been learned by the United States government?
Well, we find, at least on the part of the Obama administration, a good deal of caution with respect particularly to Iran's program. What was learned in the 2003 invasion of Iraq was that better be careful before you intervene for reasons of international peace and security, that there is sufficient grounds for saying that they have a weapon, or they have, or they're on the verge of producing a weapon. Here, of course, we have a big disagreement with the Israelis as to how probable the information should be. The Obama administration has accepted the premise, learning from the invasion of Iraq in 2003, that we better be damn sure that, in fact, the Iranians do have an active program to obtain weapons of mass destruction.
Dr. C.M. Brown is our guest in this conversation about the international responsibility to protect. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. So let's talk about what's happening in the summer of 2014 in relationship to the activities of the United States exercising the responsibility to protect. What are some of the areas?
Well, most dramatically in the news just about every day are two situations today. One, what's happening in Syria, and the other, what's happening in Iraq again. These are situations in which in Syria, well over 100,000 people have been massacred, okay, by the Assad regime. And in Iraq, the religious factions are engaged in what we used to call ethnic cleansing, and that is in massacring members of the opposing religion. And in neither country is the regime in power able to exercise its responsibility. In Syria, the regime in power is the culprit of these massive atrocities and killings of people. And in Iraq, the regime in power is paralyzed from stopping what's going on, and they are, in fact, parties to what's going on. So the Obama administration is faced with big decisions, okay? Since those governments cannot exercise their responsibility to protect, the other governments have a responsibility, and we can't get the United Nations Security Council to say that the world community should exercise that responsibility. So Obama then, like presidents before him, has to make a decision as to whether or not, in the absence of those legitimizing authorizations, either by the Security Council or by a larger coalition, whether the United States should go in on its own.
In making that analysis, what are the issues that are weighed?
The issues that are weighed primarily have to do with what are called the just war criteria for military intervention.
Can you give us some examples, first in Syria and then in Iraq?
Yes, right. The just war criteria, first of all, require that it be established that a fundamental injustice is being perpetrated. That's one. The second criteria is that in engaging in military force, you will not be engaged in an expansion of the amount of suffering by the fact that you are engaging in military force, that you will not be causing more harm than good by intervening, And the third is the most difficult to satisfy, and that is that there is a probable likelihood of success of your operation. In Syria, the terrible harm that is being done, that proposition can be satisfied. The next two are very difficult to satisfy if the United States is to engage in a military operation. One is that the fact of intervening itself will not cause even greater bloodshed than allowing the situation to take its own course, even though there's tremendous bloodshed. And the third is the most difficult of all, and the one that most obviously is constraining the Obama administration, and that is, by any standards of success, okay, bringing about a better situation, bringing about a cessation of hostilities, with the application of military force, the expectation that that will happen is very low. So Obama is constrained by these standard considerations, they're called just war considerations, from intervening with military force. What he is doing is saying we will provide some aid of various kinds to factions in Syria that seem to be on the right side, but even that is very difficult to determine what of the rebel factions are indeed on, quote, the right side of these conflicts. And similar considerations come to bear in Iraq.
And those are?
One has to do with a terrible injustice being perpetrated upon the population. It maybe hasn't reached that level yet. What that level is highly subjective. There are no standard quantifiable criteria.
And defining the injustice, you would say?
Well, that would be that innocent people are being killed. Okay. Innocent people are being killed in the crossfire. Has it reached the level where the loss of innocent life is so terrible that the conscience of humankind and so on is aroused? It may be reaching that and by what's going on. As yet, the U.S. government is not ready to say that, just as it has been reluctant in many cases, like in the case of the former Yugoslavia, to call ethnic cleansing genocide. Okay, didn't want to call it genocide because that sets too great an obligation on us to do something about it, to stop it.
I want to cover two more areas. One is ethnic cleansing, and two, what is going on in Syria and Iraq. But let's start with ethnic cleansing. To me, that carries a connotation that some ethnicities are dirty.
Mm.
You were saying we used to call it ethnic cleansing, and it was not called genocide.
Mm-hmm.
What is the difference?
Mm-hmm. I don't think there is a real difference.
Why is it called ethnic cleansing?
It was called ethnic cleansing because ethnic cleansing is not prohibited by the Treaty Against Genocide. The Treaty Against Genocide is a solemn treaty that obligates all members, all parties to it, to do something to stop it. Okay. The responsibility to protect, in addition to the responsibility to protect against threats to international peace and security, had one other component, and that was genocide. In other words, never again shall we allow a Hitler to do what he did in the 1930s. Okay, never again. So genocide does establish a responsibility to protect. The United States and other governments did not want to be required to intervene in the former Yugoslavia. Not to be required. We wanted to have the option and the right to intervene, but not be required by our own international and domestic law, which requires that we intervene in cases of genocide.
So is this not a different name for doing the same thing?
Right. It's a euphemism. It's a different name for the same thing.
Let's move on. Looking at Iraq and Syria and recognizing they're two different situations with many different cultural aspects, can you foresee the consequences on both sides of either providing a protection or not providing protection in the future development of both of those countries?
Well, developments which in both cases, the United States will be damned if it does and damned if it doesn't. If we stay out, we will be damned for allowing the conflicts to escalate to such a stage that more and more people are being killed and more innocent people are being killed. That, I think, will happen if the conflicts continue along the course that they have already taken in both places. So we will be accused, the United States will be accused, of not exercising its moral and legal responsibility to prevent that type of thing from happening, particularly if it begins to approach the level of genocide. Okay. We will be condemned for that. The United States will be condemned for it. If the United States does intervene in military force, okay, we will become part of the conflicts, okay, and the United States government will be condemned for enlarging the conflict, okay, because I doubt that we will be able to effectively suppress it, just like we were not able after over 10 years to effectively suppress the Taliban in Afghanistan. We were lucky, the United States was lucky, that it looked like the United States could effectively suppress the insurgency in Iraq in year 2007-2008 by something that was called the Anwar Awakening or the Arab Awakening, where some of the factions that were engaged in brutality felt that they were tricked by al-Qaeda into engaging in more atrocities than they should, and consequently, they cooperated with the United States. These were Sunnis, cooperated with the United States and with the Shiite Iraqi government to bring about a ceasefire. That happened as a result of what was called the surge in American troops in 2007, 8, and 9. Okay. That option, I don't think, will be available in Iraq in the future. And if we become involved, we won't have the luck of that kind of situation developing. We will become a party to the conflict.
When you say that option will not be available, what is your thinking?
Well, the thinking is that that was a narrow and lucky occurrence. It should not have happened if the dice came up in a normal way, but they didn't. It was very lucky that that happened at that time. I doubt that that will happen again, and I think the probabilities are so low that we should operate under the assumption that it won't happen, that an important faction conducting the insurgency, and in this case now it's the al-Qaeda offshoot, which is called ISIS, will somehow come to the conclusion that they will be better off if they compromise with the existing government, call a ceasefire, and participate in the governmental process. I think that they have gone so far in capturing so many places in northern Iraq that they feel that victory is on their side, and why should they compromise also? And also that they have come to the conclusion that their brothers were tricked in the earlier phase in 2007 through 2009. And the promises that they were given for fuller participation in the government were never honored. So why should they think they would be honored in the future? And since they're riding high now and getting a lot of support, getting a lot of financial support, and making a lot of money their own by breaking into banks in the cities that they've reconquered, they're going to win. It will take time, but they're going to win as far as they are concerned. So there's no reason to expect that they're willing to compromise as they did in the 2007 through 2009 period.
I want you to address the same issues as to Syria, but also define ISIS.
Yeah, well, simple definition of ISIS, that's the abbreviation for the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. Some people call it the Iranic State of Iraq and the Levant. Some people call it ISIL. And now the group that has called itself ISIS has said, we want to be called just the Islamic State, because that's what we are. We are no longer simply in Syria, okay? We are the state, the legitimate state of Syria, the legitimate state of Iraq, and the legitimate state of Syria. In fact, we are not simply a state, we are the caliphate. which is we are the ruling group that transcends borders, transcends boundaries. Now, you asked Syria, what are the prospects? Well, in Syria, the prospects are very bleak because the government of Assad, the Assad dictatorship and government, has been winning out against the insurgents. Okay, they have been beating them. The government has regrouped, and where it was losing control of certain cities and towns and villages, it is now regaining them. And also, they are being supported with heavier and heavier equipment from Iran, who wants the Assad regime, Bashar Assad, to prevail against the dissidents. Why? Because the dissidents are mainly Sunnis, and against the Shiite-leaning government, though it's an offshoot of this of the normal Shiites, the Alawite government of Bashar Assad. Iran wants them to be a satellite of Iran, okay, and to therefore expand its sphere of influence and control. And so they are aiding the government, okay, and the insurgents are not a very good prospect for outsiders to aid because they are fighting among themselves. Some of them are al-Qaeda. Not all of them are moderate. It's very difficult to tell who the moderates are and who the al-Qaeda faction is. Okay? So the United States doesn't really want to get mixed up in that battle, nor do other countries want to get mixed up in that battle. So I think Assad will win.
Dr. C.M. Brown, thank you for being with us on Radio Curious.
I'm pleased to have the opportunity to discuss these issues with you.
For 55 years, Dr. C.M. Brown has taught at major universities, been a special advisor to the Departments of Defense and State, and has written 12 books on the United States foreign policy and international relations. The book he recommends is The Five Myths About Nuclear Weapons by Ward Wilson. You may also hear our first 2014 conversation with Dr. Brown about the contradictions within the United States nuclear weapons policy and the two 1995 Radio Curious interviews with Dr. Brown discussing President Clinton's foreign policy on our website. That's radiocurious.org. There are over 500 archive editions of Radio Curious on our website, www.radiocurious.org, where they're free for you to stream, download, enjoy, and share. We appreciate your curiosity, ideas, comments, and questions. You may reach us by email. Our address is curious@radiocurious.org or snailmail 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California 95482, or by phone 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. Christina Onnestad is our associate producer, and I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.